They had taken her to another room, once again constructed of the lightning bolt white material. A series of white pipes ran across the room at about 9 feet above the bright floor. What the pipes contained, Bridget couldn't begin to guess. Perhaps they were just cylindrical bars, shapes that held nothing at all. General Sergei watched with a grim smile on his lips as two of the soldiers produced a metal chain from an alcove in the back of the small room and wound it around Bridget's wrist, binding her hands before her and leaving a long length of chain trailing along the floor. Once that was done, one of the soldiers tossed the length of chain over the pipes to a soldier who stood across from him waiting to catch it. Without a word, the catcher yanked the chain and Bridget was drawn backward and up, her arms stretching over her head. She hung from the pipe by the chain, the outstretched toes of her boots just 2 inches from the floor. It was an uncomfortable position, with all of her weight pulling at her shoulders, but Bridget was physically superior to a normal woman, strong enough to handle this punishment without complaint, at least for a little while. The general silently admired Bridget as she hung there like a piece of meat, his eyes slowly working their way up from her toes to her face, lingering for a long time on her hips and torso, feasting on her curves. Bridget watched him, seeing the predatory glint in his eyes, trying her best to relax her muscles as she hung uncomfortably from the chain.
You are quite a woman, I think.
Thank you.
I think we will have much fun before you are dead, yes?
The general pulled a pair of leather gloves from his pocket.
I'm always up for fun.
He stepped forward then, and his gloved fist was a blurring motion before her as he swung a heavy punch into the left side of her face. The vision in her left eye blurred over with hot, salty tears. Before she had time to recover, the general swung again, his left fist driving a fierce jab into her stomach. As she continued swinging, Bridget felt something trickle down her face and realized that her nose was bleeding. Bridget Baptiste was still sitting on the floor before the desk, cross-legged, facing the rug hanging from the pitons that Grant had hammered into the ceiling. In the unforgiving illumination of the xenon flashlight, two things were made starkly clear. Her eyes were closed, and there was a glistening line of blood trickling from her left nostril.
Come on, Baptiste. Don't get yourself stuck in some stupid head game now.
Kane reached forward, his hands grabbing Bridget's shoulders, ready to shake her awake, but Grant stopped him.
Remember what Lakesh said. We're not to disturb her, right? This is way out of our field of expertise, Kane. I think we had better report this and make our next move very carefully.
Fine. She had better be okay.
As Kane knelt there, looking at the trickle of blood coming from Bridget's nose, a purple-black bruise erupted over her left eye, forming from nowhere. Grant pointed to the ceiling, but Kane wasn't looking at him.
I'll go upstairs and file the report while you stay here and watch her.
He walked backward to the door, his eyes never leaving the two people on the floor, before turning and exiting the room. After a moment, Grant's face reappeared in the doorway.
And Kane, until we hear different, you take a hands-off approach to this, no matter what you see, right?
Yeah, get going. I'll hold the fort.
He and Bridget were Anamkaras, soul friends for eternity. Watching her being tortured like this, her body being marked as if from within, hurt Kane as well. But it hurt most that, for now at least, there wasn't a damn thing he could do about it. Bridget blinked back the tears from her eyes, looking at General Sergei as he stood less than 2 feet away from her, his face on a level with hers.
I have questions, but I believe you will need softening up before we get to those, Miss Baptiste.
Why don't you just try asking them? I'll gladly cooperate.
No, let's do this my way. The questions can wait a little while, I'm sure.
Bridget had the man's measure then, as if she hadn't guessed before now. Hurting people, torturing and killing them, that was just a sport to him. A way to while away the hours. The scars on Dr. Djugashvili's wrists hinted that he had been subjected to the same torture as this. The story about Dr. Krylova's death at the general's hands offered another hint. Bridget's answers regarding her counter-revolutionary status were secondary to the sport. The game he wanted to play with his new piece of meat.
General, it would be of much benefit to you and your men if I could speak with Dr. Djugashvili immediately. And I have no objections if you feel that that should occur here in your presence. But you must understand that there is more at stake than the security of Soviet Russia.
We can get to that in good time. There is no need for impatience, kitten. First, we can have our fun, okay?
Grant was still in the ventilation tunnel when he tried his contact.
Receiving you, Grant. Loud, but not too clearly. What's going on?
Grant lifted himself over the lip of the barred vent and climbed out into the fresh mountain air. It was well past midnight outside. The sky, a rich, deep blue, a sprinkling of stars overhead.
I'm on higher ground now. We may have a new problem. Something's happening to Bridget, some kind of physical trauma. We think it's related to the way people died here.
Where is she now, Grant, specifically?
Grant had been warned that the communication channel was no longer secure. Lakish's request to be specific meant that he should break security protocol if necessary.
Physically, she's still meditating in the office, but we presume her mental essence is elsewhere. I'm guessing she's with the thing we came looking for. The question is, can we wake her?
In the cave in the tall rocks, somewhere in the Australian outback, Rock Streaming crouched before the laptop. Two other people were in the cave with Rock Streaming. Rabbit in the Moon crouched on his haunches near a rocky wall beside Rock Streaming, checking at his own computer monitor, while Goodfather stood close to the doorway, his head bowed and his stance crooked. The screens showed a live image of the Caucasus mountain range, delayed by approximately 15 seconds as it bounced across the earth. A strip of tarmac in the shape of a hangman's noose could be made out to the center left of the image, and the sleek shapes of two bronze-hued manta ray-shaped vehicles could just be discerned beside the trees if one looked carefully. The image wavered before moving in closer and picking up a dark speck beside the manta craft that could have been a man in the twilight, but could just as likely have been a wolf or a fallen limb of a tree.
Physically, she's still meditating in the office, but we presume her mental essence is elsewhere. I'm guessing she's with the thing we came looking for. The question is, can we wake her?
Rock Streaming didn't turn his attention from the computer as Goodfather took several steps closer from behind him.
The woman is clearly in this other realm.
Which means she's with the weapon. Now's the time to move, Goodfather.
For the moment, I have to strongly advise against it, Grant. We have no idea what sort of trauma that might cause. Our biometric data here shows that she's in no immediate danger. Her heart rate fluctuates a little, but it's well within acceptable limits. Nothing out of the ordinary, Grant.
From the corner of his eye, Rock Streaming saw that Goodfather was nodding.
Lock the picture, as well as the biodata feed. Block their live feed so that we may enter unnoticed.
Rock Streaming nodded. He accessed a sequence he had previously set up with Rabbit in the Moon for this very eventuality. The live feeds that provided satellite imagery and biometric data were now looped to provide a reasonable facsimile of a continuing feed.
This won't stand up to too much examination, but unless they're looking for it, it should fool them.
In the Cerberus Ops Center, Lakish took in the satellite image of the Caucasus Mountains. Looking closely, he imagined that he might be able to identify a speck that could be Grant talking to him, close to the grounded mantas, but he couldn't be certain.
What about going into the zone with Bridget? Could me or Kane do that, maybe?
It's the magic eye picture argument. Magic eye pictures were a phenomenon at the end of the 20th century, where a three-dimensional image of, say, a sailboat could be seen in a two-dimensional pattern, but only if the viewer was able to defocus their eyes sufficiently. Some people could do this with ease, but for others, the pictures never appeared. It is my contention that without the proper mental discipline, you and Kane would be ill-suited to enter the zone, as you put it. You may never see the sailboat.
We're kind of stuck playing the waiting game, then. Is that what you're telling me?
Lakish watched the feed from Bridget's subcutaneous transponder.
Bridget's transponder will alert us if there's any need for action. And either Reba or I am here monitoring that at all times now. I know it's frustrating. But however it may look, there's no sign here of physical trauma, Grant.
Lakish watched as the heart rate dipped back to its normal level, a little slower, in fact, suggesting that Bridget was at rest. He expanded all three feeds from his field operatives. Heart rates, blood pressure, and brainwave activity all remained reassuringly normal. There was nothing to worry about, Lakish told himself, as Domi arrived carrying two mugs of steaming herbal tea, one for him and one for herself.
Hold your nerve, friend Grant.
Understood, Cerberus. Kane might take a bit of convincing, though. I'll report back later.
Yes. Good luck with Kane.
Kremensov kicked Bridget for the sixth time beside her right hip. General Sergei had left the younger man to the task, instructing him to get as much payback as he felt was reasonable for the loss of his front tooth while he dealt with another matter. Kremenchuk had punched her in the gut about a dozen times, then began walking around her as she hung from the pipes, kicking her from different angles and laughing when she cried out. Finally, Kremenchuk stepped back, looking at her bloodied face as she struggled to raise her head to look at him.
Are all you counter-revolutionaries so weak?
Let me speak to Dr. Djugashvili. Please.
Maybe in a while. I'm sure that the general will decide when.
General Sergei returned from whatever assignment had taken him from the little, fiercely lit room. Walking across the room, he dismissed Kremenchuk and the other sentry with a casual wave of his hand before standing before Bridget. He smiled when he saw the bruises on her face, the blood trickling from both nostrils and the gobs of spittle that clung to her chin.
You've been having quite some fun without me, but now, kitten, I think it's time you started talking.
Please, get me Dr. Djugashvili.
He doesn't give the orders in this facility, Miss Baptiste.
But he's the only one likely to understand what trouble you're all in.
In the sacred tribal hut, Neverwalk watched as the members of the strike team prepared themselves for the oncoming mission. Following the briefest of discussions with Goodfather immediately after the most recently overheard broadcast, Badfather had given the order to move out. It was clear that they needed to act on their information now, or fear either discovery or losing their chance of recovering the astral weapon for their own use. Including Neverwalk, there were now six people in the armory hut, stashing weapons about their persons, readying themselves for the long walkabout through the dreaming. Rockstreaming appeared calm. He wore his long duster open to reveal an undershirt that left his tattooed shoulders bare. Tucked into his kangaroo hide waist holsters were two boomerangs carved of razor-sharp titanium, weighted and potentially lethal. Neverwalk had seen Rockstreaming fell an eagle from the sky on one occasion and loose a koala from the branch it clung to by cleaving clean through its clinging arms on another, both at a distance of 100 or more paces. Rockstreaming had brought a portable computer with him, and as the others suited up, he continued to refine the programs that they might need in the forthcoming battle with these Cerberus warriors. Rockstreaming's cousin and blood brother, Rabbit in the Moon, wore a tattered jacket in vibrant blues and greens, along with his low-slung combat pants. Rabbit in the Moon had elected to remain bare-chested, proud of his tattooed circuitry, twin homage to the old days and the new ways. He was checking the thin shafts of each of his arrows before adding them to the quiver he would carry on his back. The compound bow, a 200-year-old tungsten steel artifact, waited at the desk beside the arrows, its weight and targeting system perfectly attuned to Rabbit in the Moon's hawk-like vision. Cloudsinger had stripped down to her abbreviated combat wear, the bandage of white material that covered her breasts, the thin white strips that wrapped her knuckles and held her wrists firm, the white skirt ending at mid-hip, and the bandage-like strips wound around her otherwise bare feet and ankles. She carried a hollowed stick, the only weapon she required other than her tightly muscled body. Goodfather looked tense as he waited to close the door of the little hut, bull roarer in hand, cup dangling at the end of its limp string. Goodfather had taken to using his gnarled walking cane once more, hollow at its tip and holding a dash of hot powder, enough to irritate a surprised opponent into making a foolish mistake. He wore a loose, short-sleeved shirt in a checkered pattern of washed-out red and black, along with baggy shorts, leaving his ancient arms and legs bare. He had settled on a pair of sandals to protect his feet, cushioning his steps, but still open to the elements. Dressed in dark pants that ended high above his ankles, his hardened feet bare and his long, brown-black toenails curling, Badfather stood at the other end of the armory, stocking up with throwing weapons, boomerang, and yo-yo. Neverwalk himself preferred the yo-yo, though he had yet to test his ability in genuine combat against a human opponent. He carried a light version of the weapon, carved wood on a string of toughened emu hide. He had displayed much prowess with the yo-yo in mock battle, entangling the limbs of lesser opponents, as well as knocking a female kangaroo senseless from his hiding place in a tree before stealing her joey for food. However, for this, his very first field mission, he would primarily be tasked with the role of lifter and handler, carrying Rockstreaming's laptop on his back and replenishing weapons if required.
What we do today will secure the original tribe's role in this dangerous new world.
The members of the strike force stopped what they were doing and looked at Badfather.
This is the next step on the long road to supremacy for each member of the tribe.
You have all trained hard. The portents are good. We shall succeed in this matter, I have no doubt. The weapon they speak of in their communications, this death cry, will be ours before the next moonrise.
Let no one stand in the way of the original men!
Everyone in the enclosed room bowed their heads respectfully as Goodfather and Badfather silently left the little hut and waited for the strike force to join them outside. Neverwalk stood beside Rock Streaming as the programmer powered down his laptop and slipped it into the harness that Neverwalk would strap across his back.
Do you really think we can win?
We must. The not original men have ruined the world, destroyed nature, destroyed themselves. We are the last hope of humankind, as our kind have always been. But without the weapons to enforce what is right, to annex and hold the dreaming, we will ever face opponents guided only by stupidity and selfishness.
We come to create new fiefdoms to rule. Are we not ourselves selfish?
Rulers come in many stripes, Cloudsinger. To make things better must never be wrong.
Rabbit in the Moon slung his quiver over his back and folded the compound bow into its holster along its side.
The written future promises ultimate victory for our tribe.
The young woman nodded at that before turning to the doorway and walking out of the hut. Neverwalk added spare arrows to the long pockets in his combat pants and placed the sharpening stone inside his jacket. Then he followed the two warrior men from the hut as they left to join Goodfather, Badfather, and Cloudsinger. Other members of the tribe waited outside in silence as the warriors prepared for their long journey through the dreaming. Badfather had described it as a three-dream minimum, but Rabbit in the Moon had plotted a different course, emerging in Africa before trekking the second leg of the journey. With the Dream Slicer, the attack would come as a complete surprise to these Cerberus people, snatching the weapon from right under their noses. The mid-morning air was warm outside, the sun reaching its zenith. Many of the original tribe members had come to proudly watch their warriors depart. An area at the edge of the settlement had been marked out using pebbles. Two rings beside one another, one small and one large. Goodfather stood in the smaller ring, his old eyes closed in contemplation. Badfather waited in the second, larger circle. The other warriors joined him, imitating his serene calm, but aware that his gaze held fiery rage as it watched them enter the circle. Badfather was ever impatient with his pupils, despite his apparently endless patience with the world around him. 3 months ago, on a mission to the Russian territories, Badfather had become too impatient with a female warrior called Dashed Accomplice and elected to leave her behind. Without access to the bull roarer that engaged the Dream Slice technology embedded in her skull, Dashed Accomplice had no way to return home to the outback and had been stranded somewhere in Russia. Dashed Accomplice's failure to return meant Cloudsinger was promoted to take her place on the strike force. Such an example served as a stern reminder that dawdling would not be tolerated. They stood across from one another, a five-pointed star within the circle. Once everyone was in place, Goodfather began to spin the bull roarer. As the drone of the bull roarer cleaved the air, Neverwalk felt the tingle at the base of his skull where the implant had come to life, fired up and awaiting his instruction. He watched Badfather, allowing his consciousness to be overwhelmed with the bull roarer's ceaseless note, waiting for the signal to depart. Suddenly, Badfather bowed his head, feeling the bull roarer dance across the spectrum to find its level. And swiftly, he raised his right arm and flicked it down again like an official starting a race, and the six of them disappeared into the dream. Both circles were now empty, just the trace of their footprints in the sand. Neverwalk felt it as exquisite pain, that sensation at the top of his spinal column as the implant flipped him into the dreaming. Its smell was familiar, the scent of dreams. Neverwalk had closed his eyes automatically in an attempt to stave off the nausea that crept up on him when he entered the dreaming like this. The others were with him, a few steps ahead, making their way across the deserted plain. Cloudsinger turned back.
Hurry, Neverwalk! Don't get left behind!
The dreaming could be hard to navigate. Some of the tribe were experts at finding their way to the part of the dream that they sought. Rabbit in the Moon had always shown an uncanny sense of tracking across the dreaming. Goodfather had said that he was an instinctive dreamwalker. Rabbit and the Moon dashed ahead, with Badfather keeping pace at his heels and the others trotting behind. Goodfather remained with the group, spinning his bull roarer overhead as he jogged, ensuring none of them would get lost or left behind. The frequency of the bull roarer determined access to the Dreaming, as well as the length and type of the journey therein. As the note burst forth, Cloudsinger took to the air. Her arms were stretched out at her sides, her body forming a straight line from toe to neck, her head raised to look forward, her mouth wide. Up ahead, Rabbit and the Moon bent in a crouch, amassing energy. And he leaped into the swollen sky like a firework, almost touching the rushing clouds as he lunged into the heavens, with Cloudsinger immediately altering her trajectory so as to follow him. Badfather went up in the air behind Rabbit and the Moon, apparently with no effort at all, just hooking into Rabbit and the Moon's slipstream and being carried into the air too. With their feet still on the shale-sprinkled ground, Goodfather glanced at Rock Streaming and Neverwalk. Rock Streaming started turning as he spoke to Neverwalk.
Come, little brother. We have much to do.
Rock Streaming continued to turn, twisting into the air like a seed fluttering in the wind. Neverwalk prepared himself, finding his mental center just as he had been taught. A hop and a jump, and he was airborne too, gathering speed as he lunged after his companions. He thrust his arms forward to cut through the air as if diving. Looking over his shoulder, he saw Goodfather sitting cross-legged, the walking cane resting across his lap as he glided low over the ground. No longer in his hands, Goodfather's bull roarer continued to spin, keeping pace with his flight above and a little behind his right shoulder. Neverwalk turned away, tucking in his head to cut down on drag as his body moved faster and faster, cleaving the skies of the Dreaming. Travel through the Dreaming was almost instantaneous, covering ground at speeds impossible in real world. 200 feet or 200 miles, it was all the same in the Dreaming. There was ground, then indigo sea below them, rushing past at a blur, lit by a sky that held the tint of green, the color of plants, of life. Neverwalk dipped to follow the other members of the strike team, his body holding the arrowhead shape as it cut through the air. The sea disappeared as he approached it, replaced by the rush of land colored the yellow of sand. Beneath him, Badfather, Cloudsinger, and Rock Streaming brought themselves into land. Neverwalk spun his body, thrusting his legs forward, bent at the knee to take the shock, and suddenly he was on solid ground once more, stumbling as his speed slowed. He staggered across the ground for 15 steps, feeling the jarring impact through his knees before finally falling down to a stop. A few paces behind him, he saw Goodfather lower himself to the ground, grabbing the handle of the bull roarer as it whirled through the air beside him. The others looked across the dirt to him as Goodfather helped his young apprentice up from the soil. It felt like flecks of dried rice there, little pieces of ground that would get caught under your fingernails. And it was empty. The only living things in this world, the world of the Dreaming, appeared to be the Strike Force.
We're here.
The spinning of the bull roarer slowed, and with it, the furious rushing of the clouds above them. The burst of fire came again then, jarring Neverwalk at the top of his spine where the implant resided, forcing him to close his eyes to hold back the tears of pain. When he opened his eyes, they were in a desert, three bony goats looking up at him, the rising sun still low in the sky.
Africa.
They were back in real world. The whole journey of 7,000 miles had taken less than 10 seconds. General Sergei looked at Brigid's helpless form hanging from the chain before him.
The trouble that we are in. I fear that your assessment of the situation is somewhat backwards, Miss Baptiste.
Brigid gritted her teeth against the pain in her stretched muscles, the aches where her body had taken punishment at the hands of Sergei and Kremensov.
Be that as it may, General, I really must insist that I speak with Dr. Djugashvili.
You are hardly in the position to insist upon anything.
At that moment, Dr. Djugashvili took a half step into the room.
I think that, with all due respect, we would be wise to listen to her, General.
Must I remind you that I am running this facility, Doctor?
Djugashvili held his gaze, and Brigid wondered if this was the first time that the doctor had actually stood up to this bullying military man.
Even you are not immune to the ravages of time, General, which is the message that I fear Miss Baptiste here came to give us.
What are you talking about? You accept the word of what? A counter-revolutionary doctor? A spy?
General Sergei's hand fumbled to unclip his holster. and he seized the Tokarev pistol and thrust it into Djugashvili's belly.
Perhaps you are in league with her. Is that it, Anastas?
Please cease this foolishness, General, for all our sakes. The barbaric treatment of the woman avails us nothing. If she is, as you suspect, a counter-revolutionary, then you may execute her at your leisure. But if she has come here with information, we would both be fools to dismiss it out of hand without so much as listening to her tale.
Fine. We shall listen to her, and then we shall decide on the appropriate course of action.
Sergei turned to Bridget and raised the pistol to aim it at her head.
You, Baptiste, speak.
Come now, General. Look at her. Your men have been very efficient. We must let her sit, clean her wounds. And I imagine that she is thirsty also.
I'm not interested in her well-being, Doctor.
Perhaps you should be.
Bridget could see the conflicting emotions cross the General's face. He was a brute who only truly understood brutish behavior, and the notion of allowing his prisoner any comfort, however minor, unsettled him greatly.
Fine. My men will unchain her, and we shall conduct the interrogation in your office, comrade.
Grant returned from his discussion with Cerberus to find Kane waiting for him in the doorway to the little brightly lit office. When he looked past Kane, he saw Bridget was still in her cross-legged position on the floor, her eyes closed. Beneath her nose, her face was cobwebbed with blood, and a trail of spittle drooled from her slack mouth. The beginnings of a black eye had formed over the left side of her face, and he could see a reddening patch of skin over her right eye where the bruise was forming.
What did Lakish say?
He says everything is fine. Transponders show Bridget's in no actual danger. All this stuff may look bad, but it has to be superficial.
Superficial, my ass. Something is very seriously messed up here.
Sure looks that way.
Grant leaned closer to Bridget and saw that there was blood along the edges of the fingernails of her right hand. He wondered what other damage she had suffered that he couldn't see.
We both know that Lakish can be a tricky bastard. You figure if he wants this death cry badly enough, he'll tell us not to disturb Baptiste despite the consequences?
Lakish is a pretty straight shooter these days, especially when it comes to Bridget.
Yeah, but a leopard never changes its spots.
Yeah, and I can believe that Lakish would throw us to the lions if it meant getting something as important as a weapon to stop the whole war. But I don't believe that's what's happening here.
I can't look at her like that and still think straight.
Kane turned away from Bridget's bruised and blood-streaked face. He left the room and paced down the unlit corridor, finding his way in semi-darkness down the little flight of steps that dropped the sunken base lower into the mountain. Grant remained crouched by Bridget, studying her wounded face before he stood and followed Kane. When he reached the doorway, he saw Kane turn back from just outside the canteen, a grim smile on his features.
What about if the readings are wrong?
Say what?
Kane tapped at his inner wrist, as though searching for his pulse.
What if the transponders are supplying bogus information and Lakish doesn't realize it? What then?
I don't know, Kane. Is that likely?
Kane walked up the small flight of steps and joined his partner at the doorway to the lit room.
Take a look at her and you tell me. Does she look in good shape right now? Honestly?
Grant looked across the room at Bridget, then back to Kane, concern creasing his brow.
Even if that were the case, would it make waking her any less dangerous?
Well, there's the rub.
Bridget sat in silence in Dr. Djugashvili's office as a handsome young lab technician called Yuri dabbed antiseptic on her cuts. She had removed her jacket to look at her arms, but other than the ridges on her wrists where the chains had cinched into her flesh, they had remained blessedly free from harm. Her legs and torso, she could feel, were a different matter, but she wasn't about to do a striptease for the lecherous General Sergei now that he was finally in a position where he might actually listen to her. Yuri dabbed at the cut over her right eye.
I'm sure it will not leave any lasting damage. It would be very sad to mar such a pretty face.
Bridget felt herself blush, and she looked down at her lap for a few seconds, avoiding eye contact with the handsome lab assistant.
Thank you.
Besides herself and the lab assistant, General Sergei and Dr. Djugashvili sat in the room. Two sentries had been placed outside, standing on either side of the open doorway.
She's just a lone woman, General. What harm can she do?
She very nearly killed Kremenzov. Okay, enough. Come, Miss Baptiste, join us.
Bridget shifted on her lightning-bright chair and edged a little closer to the General and Djugashvili at the desk.
I should begin by thanking you for your hospitality, General.
The General nodded and allowed her to continue.
Before our own discussion, I was speaking with Dr. Djugashvili concerning the status of this research facility.
You mean that you are probing him for information on this facility?
No, you misunderstand. I was trying to establish what year he thought it was.
It's 1929. This is preposterous. What point are you hoping to make with this foolishness, Miss Baptiste?
It's not 1929, General. Not by a long shot.
I fear that what she says is true, General.
So, what year is it then, Miss Baptiste? 1930? 1931?
This facility has somehow become trapped in a mockery of time. When you came here in the spring of 1928, you gave up your physical bodies for a continued existence in this astral realm, hidden in an upper level of human consciousness.
She knows too much. I shall shoot her now and be rid of the witch.
Let her speak, General.
It is the 23rd century, and the world has changed beyond recognition.
The 23rd?
At the start of the 21st century, about 70 years after you began your work here, a brief but deadly war erupted between the two most powerful nations on the planet, Russia and the United States of America. The war brought untold devastation, culling the global population and leaving the once fertile environment a death land. 200 years later, we finally discovered why. The nuke cost was orchestrated by an alien race called the Anunnaki. We are still piecing together the full story, but as we understand it, the Anunnaki have long prized the Earth as a playground full of wonderful toys to corrupt and manipulate. Those toys are us, the human race. Evidence of the Anunnaki's dabbling in human affairs reaches back over millennia. They were responsible for the great flood that appears in the Bible, and their influence on human affairs has been wide-reaching and almost always deadly. They have come back to subjugate humankind and use them as slaves or I don't know what.
You spoke of two great nations, Russia and the United States of America, going to war. Which nation do you represent, Miss Baptiste?
I represent the resistance movement that opposes the Anunnaki in their most recent incarnation as the overlords. Borders are irrelevant.
America, then. You think I am stupid?
I think you need to listen carefully. This facility, Project Chernobog, was tasked to design and hide a weapon that can be used against a significant supraterrestrial threat. That threat has arrived. And if you want to play patriot games with an outdated notion of national borders that has had no relevance for almost three centuries, then I'm going to have to assume you're just too damn scared to do your job, General.
Watch your tongue.
It seems to me, General, that the young lady has a point.
And what point is that, Doctor?
We have had no communications with the outside world in many months. And if, as Miss Baptiste proposes, time is running differently for those within this facility, then it is entirely possible that the reason for this is a massive world upheaval about which we know nothing.
But this concept that time is somehow stuck in this facility.
When asked, I told Miss Baptiste that I thought it was perhaps 1929. But when I thought about it, I could not for certain say that this was the case. It is like trying to remember a dream, trying to pin three-dimensional facts on a two-dimensional picture. Time and memory seem to be somehow ephemeral, unreal.
These concerns have never bothered us before.
They bothered Lenya Krylova before you killed her. That was why you shot her, wasn't it? She had begun to ask questions that you didn't have answers to.
You would do well to remember where you are and who is in authority here.
I am sorry, General.
I think it's time to exercise your authority, General, and bring the death cry into play.
Grant looked at Bridget's static form and the bright light cast by the xenon beam as he considered the dilemma.
I don't know, Kane. My fear is that by waking her, we could make a bad situation worse.
Kane stood beside him, looking down at their deathly still companion.
She's still breathing. That's got to be a good sign.
Grant pointed at the cut on Bridget's forehead where the bruise was forming above her eye.
Looks like her wounds are scarring over. She's no longer losing blood.
She vomited earlier while you were away. Just a little, but I cleaned it up.
Maybe we should clean up the cuts, too, so long as we don't disturb her. If the transponder's not giving Cerberus accurate data, then waking her might be a good thing. I just don't want to disturb Bridget if she's on the verge of a big discovery.
Agreed.
So we clean her, we monitor her visually, but we don't Waker.
It blows, but it's a plan I can live with.
Let's hope she can. Do you have a medikit in that bag of yours?
Kane reached for the satchel he had left on the desk, pushed against the wall with a bronze Cheka shield on it.
Roll of bandage, weave, needle, and thread. Probably enough for this.
He looked at Bridget's battered face again, dread welling inside him.
Kane, there's a medikit in the Mantas. I'll go get some antiseptic and see what else I have. I'll be 5 minutes, okay?
I'll time you.
With that, Grant turned and headed for the ventilation shaft once again, wishing he could offer Kane some kind of reassurance. A restless Domi prowled into the Cerberus ops room as the members of the afternoon shift took their positions at the monitoring equipment. Lakesh was dozing, stretched out on three seats that he had pushed together at the side of the room, determined to be nearby if there was any change in the status of the Russia field team. Reba DeFore, the Cerberus medic, had taken her place monitoring the computer display that showed the data feed from the subcutaneous transponders. On the far side of the room, Donald Bry, Skylar Hitch, and two other computer jockeys were working through pages of printouts, examining the material line by line as they searched for a way to break the hack that had infiltrated the Cerberus satellite feed. Domi saw that Brewster Filboid had taken Bry's usual spot at the communications desk, and she walked silently across the room to speak with him.
Any word from Kane?
Huh. Domi, I didn't hear you come in.
No shoes.
She smiled, lifting one of her shapely, white-skinned legs from the floor and pointing her bare foot at his face, toes outstretched.
Good and stealthy.
We heard from Grant an hour ago, but I haven't heard anything from the field crew since then. No big deal. We don't expect a report for at least another hour.
He turned back to the satellite feed, adjusting the monitoring filters. Domi leaned across the desk, cat-like, as she took in the changing feed from the Vela-class satellite.
That's the same picture.
What?
I saw that picture.
A small window showed the overhead surveillance feed of the Caucasus Mountains in Georgia.
About an hour ago, when I brought Lakesh tea.
She looked across the room and saw that the cup of herbal tea sat untouched beside Lakesh, where he dozed.
Yeah, this is where Kane's team is, the Caucasus Mountains. We're keeping a close watch in case anything approaches. Hopefully we can get a message across if anything does happen.
But this is the picture from an hour ago, look!
She pointed to the dark shadow close to the Mantas.
That's Grant, when he spoke to Lakesh. He was just wrapping up when I came in last time.
That's just a shadow.
He expanded the window to look more closely. Domi watched the wind rustle the leaves of the trees in the image.
The picture is moving, but it's been looped somehow.
How can you be sure?
I can't. But if that's Grant, it means that something is very wrong with the feed, and the rest stands to reason.
I still say it's just a shadow, or a branch or something. Maybe a rock.
He enhanced the picture, drawing the dark blemish into focus. It was indistinct, but it certainly looked like a man seen from overhead. He turned his head, realizing the dummy was right beside him, close enough to kiss.
Grant!
Filboy turned away from her and pushed himself up out of his chair.
Lakesh, Donald, you really need to come look at this.
General Sergei shook his head.
I am sorry, Keaton, but your story is beyond ludicrous. A trick. A fairy tale to fool us into unchaining the death cry for use by the enemies of Russia.
I disagree. Miss Baptiste's story is eminently plausible. Incredible, certainly, but plausible. To my mind, General, this fits with the facts.
What facts? 300 years in stasis? No contact with the outside world? I see no evidence of this. You said yourself, Doctor, that the year is 1929.
No, I said that I thought it was 1929. But that upon reflection, the salient points of my memory and my sense of time's passage seem to be incomplete or unreliable. This facility was placed outside of normal reach, and we have nothing to go on, no objective scientific facts with which to verify the woman's story.
And that is all it is, a story. A story to trick us into handing over the death cry to our enemies.
Stalemate, Bridget thought. They could go in circles forever, arguing the same basic point. And unfortunately, forever was about how long it would take, if what Djugashvili had told her was true. All the while, her believing perhaps a few hours or days or weeks had passed, when in fact it was another 300 years.
Would you like to know how the Anunnaki started the war in 2001?
This race of supraterrestrials that you speak of. Do tell, how did they start the war?
There were a lot of smart men in power. Men like you, General, who believed in national pride and the importance of defending their integrity as much as their borders. And every last one of those smart men on both sides of the Iron Curtain was so damn paranoid that he was all too willing to press the button that launched the missiles and bombed the whole planet back to the Stone Age.
Paranoid, you say? You are cunning, exploiting our fears in this way. But ultimately, I choose not to fall for your deception, Bridget Baptiste.
General Sergei flipped open the holster's flap and withdrew his Tokarev pistol.
Don't do that!
I think it would be for the best, don't you?
General! This is madness! You cannot follow this course of action
without
evidence!
Without what?
Evidence! Science demands that you disprove her contention before you execute her.
I am a military man, not a fool scientist.
With that, he placed the barrel of his Tokarev between Bridget's eyes. She felt the cold steel push against her forehead, her mind racing as she tried to come up with another solution. Lakesh stretched the kinks out of his muscles as he studied the image from the Vela-class satellite feed. Brewster Filboid had transformed the picture to the biggest screen in the room, blown up to full size. Every 30 seconds, a caption flashed up in the bottom left of the image reading, "Live feed." But Domi's observation had now put that contention into question. Lakesh turned to Donald Bry.
What do you think, Donald?
He gazed intently at the image on the screen. Filboid and Domi waited for his response, Filboid sitting at the keyboard that operated the large screen.
I'm not sure. There's definitely movement. You can see the wind catching the leaves. And there's no obvious join where the image has been looped, if it has. However, it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility.
Ugh, stupid tech heads! Never good at making decisions. No instincts, have to analyze everything.
I just don't want to be jumping at shadows because of a paranoid notion someone's put in my head.
It's not paranoia! That feed is on a fixed loop, repeating itself every minute plus.
If that is the case, then we would need to decide on a course of action.
Skylar Hitch, the computer expert who had been seconded into Donald Bry's investigation team, stood at her desk.
It is the case, Dr. Singh.
She waved a sheet of computer printout above her head. Everyone in the Cerberus Ops Center stopped what they were doing to hear what Hitch was about to announce. She moved across the room to join the group at the satellite monitor feed, feeling increasingly self-conscious.
I've isolated the hacker's coding. He's in the comm network and the satellite feeds, and it looks like he's taking control of the transponder relays as well.
What?
Reba DeFore, currently monitoring the transponder feed, turned her attention back to her monitor. She brought up the enhanced details for Bridget, Grant, and Kane. Lakesh quickly scanned Skylar's printout before handing it back to her.
Well, this certainly puts an interesting spin on things. Anything, Reba?
As far as I can tell, this is a normal feed. There's no indication that anything's been tampered with.
Our hackers probably looped a sequence from earlier, the same way he's dealt with the surveillance feed.
The rest of the room was quiet, looking to Lakesh for instructions. Donald Bry, a man who always wore an expression of worry, had gone visibly pale.
Lakesh?
Okay, people. We are officially deaf and blind. Our ability to track our own people has been compromised, and we can no longer rely on the data that we are receiving. We have a field team out there that requires our support and assistance, and that may well be in more danger than we realized. What we do know is that, though tapped, our communications to the field team still appear to be in working order.
Couldn't those communications have also been faked, Lakesh?
Lakesh looked to Skylar Hitch, who was still holding her printout and looking slightly uncomfortable at having been the center of attention.
Miss Hitch?
It's possible. I don't know what the likelihood of that is, though.
Wouldn't we know if the Mantis had been moved, Lakesh?
Let's not assume anything. From here on in, we are to act in complete isolation. Line of sight confirmation on everything. Is that understood? Donald, Skylar, I need you to purge the whole system of this hack. I don't care what it takes, and I don't care what we lose.
But Lakesh,
no,
what about the ships?
If we built it once, we can build it again. If we programmed it once, we can program it again. Just get this thing out of the Cerberus mainframe.
Bry nodded, and Hitch followed him back to the desks.
Brewster, Reba, for the present, your feeds are useless. If you can come up with any possible ways of working around this, let me know.
We'll figure something out.
We might be able to piggyback off the keyhole satellite and create a secondary feed for the transponders.
Then look into that, Filboid. For the present, monitoring duty is suspended with the exception of communications.
Lakesh strode across the room, taking another look at the bogus satellite feed showing the Caucasus Mountains. He felt suddenly very vulnerable as he saw the flashing live feed indicator pop up for a few seconds. Domi stepped across from her position, leaning against one of the desks, and placed an arm around his waist.
Is it the end of the world again?
No, dearest. I guess not.
Domi reached in to kiss him lightly on the cheek. Then she pulled away, giving him a significant look.
What is it?
Lakesh had known Domi for a long time, as first a friend and later his lover. He knew that look.
I'm going to join Kane.
But
no,
we don't
I'm
know.
Going. Someone needs to tell them what's happened. Line of sight communications, that's what you said.
The effort that has gone into this means there's a good chance there's going to be a wealth of trouble there in the mountains.
All the more reason to send backup.
She let go of his waist and started for the exit.
I'll go to the armory while you figure out the closest operational MatTrans point on your big map here, okay?
Since when did you start giving orders?
Aw, you love it, really.
Lakesh smiled at the petite frame of his lover. She was right. It wasn't the end of the world. Not for them. But he couldn't speak for Brigid, Kane, or Grant. The Tokarev was held steady against the bone between Brigid's eyes.
Contact headquarters. Speak to your superiors.
No, Miss Baptiste. I don't need their permission to execute a counter-revolutionary dog like you. I am the ultimate authority in this facility. I have no need to verify my actions with my superiors.
I understand that, General. But in speaking to them, you will disprove my story and be able to shoot me in good conscience.
It has been nice meeting you, kitten.
Do not pull that trigger, General.
Brigid looked hopefully over the General's shoulder, imagining that perhaps Djugashvili had a pistol of his own stored in his desk, but he was empty-handed.
I am of the firm opinion that we should contact the KGB and confirm the situation in the corporeal world before we execute the woman.
And why is that, Dr. Djugashvili?
Because if what she tells us proves to be true, then your counter-revolutionary is the only link we have to the outside world.
General Sergei relented, lowering the Tokarev from Brigid's forehead, but still training it on her. He rose from his seat and walked across to stand beside the open doorway to the white-walled room, the weapon still pointing in her direction.
You have friends in the outside world, Miss Baptiste?
Yes.
And they will be sympathetic to our situation?
My friends are one of the few bastions of human resistance to the alien threat, Doctor. If you and the General are courageous enough to use the Death Cry weapon in battle against the Anunnaki, then you will be hailed as heroes. I promise you that.
Very well. We shall contact headquarters.
The General turned and exited the room. Brigid caught Djugashvili's eye.
Thank you.
I have a brief errand to attend to. Chain the woman up until I return.
Brigid's heart sank. The two sentries marched into the room and took her by the elbows. She was back precisely where she had started. Lakesh turned as Domi entered the ops center at a fast trot. She had changed her clothes and was now wearing a parka coat, with a faux fur collar over a cream blouse and dark full-length trousers and boots. The parka was a muddy leaf color, all the better for blending into the background trees of the Caucasus Mountains. With the coat open, Lakesh could see that she had her trusted Detonix Combat Master 45 holstered in a shoulder rig along with a viciously sharp blade in a leather sheath on her belt. She hefted a compact Uzi in her hands, feeling its weight for comfort.
Uzi? Not your usual choice.
It's just a little something for the masses. Never know who I'm going to bump into.
Worry crossed Lakesh's features, but Domi gently touched his arm.
It'll be okay. A little change of scene is all. With bullets.
Nodding, Lakesh pointed up to the large map of the world that covered one wall of the op center. He had set the Mercator relief map to show specific points at his commands, and he flipped a control switch to dim the lights so that his instructions were clear.
Our field team is here, in the green circle near the old Russian border. The most efficient way to get you there would be by the interfacer, but there's no energy vortex in the vicinity of our friends. We've located an old Soviet naval base here, just outside a fishing town called Poti.
An amber light sparked to life beside the throbbing green circle, touching on the Black Sea.
Our tests show that a working MatTrans exists in the base, although we cannot be certain that the base itself is empty. We'll send you to this MatTrans, and if you run into any resistance, you are to jump back immediately. Immediately, Domi. You hear me?
Aye, aye, Skipper.
I'm serious about this. Now, Poti is perhaps 25 miles west of your final destination, which means you'll have some territory to cover once you get there. We're going to try to get a message through to Kane's team and see if he or Grant can come find you in one of the mantas. But, as you know, we can no longer guarantee the veracity of communiques in this regard. So it may be that you're on your own.
I understand.
Lakesh stepped back and reached for a bundle of papers in a sealed, stay-dry pouch. Here's a map of the area, as well as a second map showing operational Matran's units in a 200-mile radius from your landing point, in case you need to exit via a different route. The main map shows the terrain with markings for the best route and your final destination. There may be some climbing involved, I'm afraid, but let's hope that Kane or Grant can come find you before that.
Yep.
We've also included several satellite photographs of the immediate area, which may be useful if there are any discrepancies between the old maps and the current lay of the land. From our most recent surveillance sweep, the area is mostly unpopulated once you get away from the coast, so you shouldn't run into any trouble. Shouldn't doesn't equate to won't, of course.
Of course.
Lakesh led the way to the antechamber that held the Matran's unit. Farrell was already there, prepping the unit for use, and he silently acknowledged Lakesh and Domi as they approached.
If there is any trouble, I want you back here straight away. Just a swift jump there and back, nothing more, okay?
It will be fine!
Domi settled her parka's hood down behind her neck, its faux fur brushing against her earlobes. She stepped into the armorglass-walled unit. Farrell pulled the door shut behind her, sealing her in the room. Suddenly, a mist rose from the vents as the Matran's unit prepared to blast Domi's atoms across the map and into faraway Georgia. Grant made his way back through the wide, sludge-filled ventilation shaft with the medikit from his manta.
Kane! Grant! Do you need me?
This is Grant. I hear you, Brewster, but the message is breaking up. Say again, your message is broken. Please stand by, and I'll let you know when I'm on higher ground. Copy?
Grant stopped in the tunnel, the small metal box of medical supplies held loosely in his left hand as he waited for a response from Cerberus.
Message received, Grant. We'll be with...
Grant sprinted to the low end of the ventilation shaft.
Kane! Kane!
As he lowered himself through the busted grill and into the underground Soviet base, Kane appeared in the doorway of the room, microlight in hand.
What is it?
I've just had a message from Cerberus.
Grant passed the medikit across to Kane.
Sounds urgent. I'm going topside to get a proper signal. Will you be okay taking care of Bridget?
I'll be fine. Any idea what they want?
Dunno. Just heard Philboy trying to raise us. Breaking protocol, so I assume it's pretty urgent.
You want me to come up and speak to him?
Stay with Bridget. It's where you want to be. They need to speak to you, I'll shout down, okay?
Thanks. Baptiste seems stable, at least.
Good.
Grant disappeared into the huge ventilation pipe once more. Minister Petrovna stood before her congregation in the cavernous church hall in Poti. She wore the ornate robe of office, a red dress with a golden starfield pattern stitched across it, and the mitre that added almost 2 feet to her height.
God hears the pleas of all her children.
The meeting hall was cold, despite the mild weather outside, and her congregation looked miserable and desperate. They numbered fewer than 40 now. The whole town of Poti had been whittled down by disease and famine and the burning hunger they all held inside, and they had pinned their dwindling hopes on God. For Minister Petrovna, at least, business was booming. A hand went up in the middle of the gathered group. The hand was attached to a thin arm, and the arm belonged to Donatas, a 25-year-old fisherman whose family, the minister knew, was on the brink of starvation. At 25, Donatas looked like a man in his 50s.
When will we eat? When will God bring us food?
Soon. An angel will come from the heavens to bring us God's bounty. I've seen this in my visions.
Petrovna really had seen this in one of her visions, although the validity of the visions of a woman on the very edge of starvation might be brought into question were it not that her congregation was also subject to the same hallucinations due to lack of protein. Their coastal town was self-reliant and resourceful in the tough and unforgiving world of the long post-Nuke-cost recovery. But something had poisoned the fishing waters, a rainstorm that belched toxins into the water and the lands all around. The plants had continued to grow, the fish had continued to swim, but they were bad plants now, bad fish. The contamination was rife, and the vast community had been cut down to a tenth of its number in the space of a few months. In such trying times, people turned to Minister Petrovna for advice and salvation, and she had done her best to assure them that all would be well, as their pets, and then their children, and then their old folks wilted away before their eyes. Once upon a time, the church hall had been a part of the naval base on the shores of the Black Sea. But the ships had long since gone, the sailors dead and forgotten. The old usage had made way for the new. Minister Petrovna had inherited the church from another minister in a gunfight that had left the man of the cloth bleeding in the street for 3 days before he finally passed away. By mutual agreement, it was decided that Minister Petrovna clearly had God's will behind her, and that the old man had been nothing more than a fraud and a fool. While she may be the chosen of the Almighty, Minister Petrovna chose to remain heavily armed. As it was written, God protected those who heavily armed themselves. The congregation was getting restless, she could tell. They wanted food, not promises.
God's bounty is rich, and she's generous. She has helped us all to survive this long. We, her faithful. This test of our faith is almost at an end.
At that very moment, there was a sudden flash of lightning from the stained glass wall behind the minister. The glass was a smoky violet in color and had been there for just as long as anyone could remember. The stained glass surrounded a storage room, just a box with a tiled floor. In all of her days there, Minister Petrovna had never seen the room flash with lightning. She paced across to the glass-walled room, watching as a wave of fog seemed to fill the room before parting to reveal a bulky figure inside where there had been no one before. Minister Petrovna stood outside the door to the room, her congregation waiting eagerly behind her. As they waited, the figure inside the room made its way to the door. A woman stood revealed, dressed in a bulky green coat that ended in a fur-lined collar. The woman had short, close-cropped hair, and her face was a beautiful combination of high cheekbones covered in smooth, iridescent skin. And the woman was white as snow, her hair and her skin a dazzling alabaster. Minister Petrovna knew immediately what the beautiful woman was.
Welcome, angel!
Domi opened her eyes and found herself slumped on the floor of a Mattrans unit. Beyond the armor glass walls, she could see figures moving. Carefully, Domi righted herself, forcing her muscles to move as she climbed up from the tiled floor. All around her, wisps of smoke were dissipating where the Mattrans unit was powering down, and she could see battered boxes and crates full of ammunition and books on the far side of the room. Mattrans travel was an altogether unpleasant experience. When her nausea passed, Domi made her way to the door. She was greeted by a crowd of people, at least 30 of them that she could see, all of them looking tired and disheveled. Standing in the front of the group, smiling benignly, was a middle-aged woman wearing a long red dress and a tall hat.
Welcome, angel!
Domi realized that everyone in the room was watching her, awaiting her next move, their feral eyes glinting and sharp teeth displayed. Despite Domi's assurances to Lakesh, it wasn't fine. Not by a long shot. Domi spun into the crowd, behind the lady in the red dress.
An angel!
The crowd certainly seemed pleased to see Domi. They greeted her with open arms. But there was something sinister about the whole occasion, an undercurrent that Domi felt instinctively.
Look at her beautiful fingers!
Give me some room, I can't breathe!
The crowd ignored her as they huddled closer.
Everybody will get a piece of the angel. Hold her down.
Minister Petrovna produced a meat cleaver from somewhere in her long layered dress.
I'll make the first incision.
The disheveled woman who had been admiring Domi's finger suddenly pulled at the albino woman's wrist, yanking her closer. Domi made a fist and the woman's sharp teeth clamped down on a knuckle. Across from her, a man was trying to pull Domi's left arm behind her back, trapping it. She bent, loosening the man's grip and rolling him over her shoulders. Domi realized they were cannibals or something very similar. She'd touched down in a great big gathering of the vile bastards, and it was clear that they were hungry for albino meat. Grant stood beside the broken ventilation grill as he spoke to Cerberus over the contact. Brewster Filboid had been replaced by Lakesh, who explained the situation in brief.
We have significantly more than just communication problems, and it seemed judicious to send another agent to join you in the field.
Understood.
Domi has jumped to a Mattrans unit in the old naval base at Poti. The coordinates have been forwarded to the Mantas. Do you think you can track her down, Grant?
Couldn't you patch through her transponder signal? I could lock in on that and pick her up in next to no time.
That may be problematic. We can try, but we've been having trouble with the transponder signals.
Grant thought of Bridget and the conversation he'd been having with Kane not so long ago about the apparent discrepancy of her condition and the transponder data's interpretation.
Patch it through.
Grant climbed into the cockpit of his Manta.
And I'll assume it's with a pinch of salt.
As soon as the communication with Cerberus was finished, Grant hailed Kane, hoping the signal would penetrate into the underground bunker enough to explain the situation.
Kane, I got a rush job on, you hear me?
Receiving you only weekly. What's happening?
Domi's here. Say again, Domi's here. Needs a taxi service to pick her up from the airport.
A blip on Grant's heads-up display indicated Domi's location in the coastal town of Poti.
I'll be back inside of an hour. You copy?
1 hour, gotcha.
With that, Grant powered the Manta into the skies and headed west. Yuri walked through the door carrying a bottle of alcohol and a roll of gauze.
I wanted to take another look at your wounds.
It's very kind.
Bridget struggled to keep her head raised to maintain eye contact. Her muscles were screaming with pain from fatigue and discomfort. The lab assistant removed the cap from the alcohol before placing a bald rag over the top and tipping it upside down. Once the rag was soaked, he began dabbing it at the cut above Bridget's eye, cleaning the wound of debris. It stung, but Bridget endured it in silence. Once Yuri finished cleaning the wound, he examined it closely, nodding with satisfaction.
It shouldn't cause you any trouble, just a bit of swelling. You have another cut on your cheek.
You're very thoughtful.
She looked closely at the man. He couldn't have been much more than 19 or 20 years of age. He had thrown his whole life away, albeit unwittingly, on this fabulous project.
But Dr. Djugashvili tells me you have come from the future.
Bridget smiled. No, she thought, you're stuck in the past. But it didn't bear explaining.
It's true. A long way in the future. The 23rd century.
It is incredible. A modern wonder. My mother would never believe such a thing possible, that I, her son, met a visitor from the future.
Your mother must have seen a lot of change. You must miss her.
Not so much. Mostly I miss my brothers and sister. My mother would have much difficulty comprehending where it is that I work. This whole research facility is an exceptional construction.
I can't argue with you there.
The future. What is it like?
It's... The future is very different from what you remember, Yuri. There was such a flurry of achievement in the 20th century. It must have seemed that the miracles would never stop coming. But one day it ended. Literally in the space of a few hours. There was an atomic war, a war of such incredible destruction that it stunted humankind for 2 centuries.
But where you are from, what is that like? What is it like to live in the future?
It's a struggle every day. Did Dr. Djugashvili tell you why I'm here?
He says that you have come requesting our charity.
Man may have fought the war that started the 21st century, but it is an alien race called the Anunnaki who have reaped the benefits. We have struggled with their opposing army, which has superior technology, aircraft and guns and things that you couldn't begin to imagine. The device that you have constructed here, the Death Cry, could change the face of that war. With it, we could end 200 years of exploitation, millennia of manipulation.
You believe that the Death Cry could do this?
I have read Dr. Djugashvili's original reports. I think it's worth a try.
My mother saw many changes in their homeland. She said that brave men change things for the better.
Bridget considered the young man's subjective age. His mother would have lived through the October Revolution, the dethroning of the Tsar, the rise of the Soviet Socialist Republics. He himself was probably too young to remember those changes, just a child when Russia's identity and her people's way of life had changed so utterly. Yuri himself had a strange kind of immortality in this realm, a useless kind of eternity that meant nothing ever changed for him and the other people working here.
I need brave men, men who can make tough decisions.
You have come here at great personal risk to fight for what you believe in. I think perhaps that all brave men are not men at all, Miss Bridget.
I'll take that as a yes, scrambled syntax and all.